Hello and welcome to Mental Notes from My Minivan. This is Kirsty Sayer. It has been a minute, not because I actually haven't been recording, because I have, but things keep changing in my life, and then I think, you know what, I'm going to do a whole new episode to incorporate those changes and those discoveries and that information. So here we are. I feel like I've got more than enough to fill up an episode. And I gotta just pull the trigger before more stuff happens, and then we'll, I guess, just do further episodes. You know, I get blocked. So, I'm not going to give in to the getting blocked with too much stuff to say anymore. I also recorded a phenomenal interview with Doug Lang, my friend, who we also refer to as Big Ugly Mandel by his own that's actually his own moniker. But the audio was sadly so bad that we've decided to re-record. So when you get word of that, make sure to hustle and tune in, because that man has so many nuggets of extraordinary wisdom and is just a really fun person to listen to as well, and a great friend. So, without further ado, I would like to start at the very beginning, which is today, and work my way back. That's how I'm gonna work. Otherwise it gets too overwhelming. So today, is Monday, and I have to tell you that it dawned early and gray, and I was tired because I haven't been sleeping well. It's been a week of quite significant turmoil and stuff like that. And if you're bored of hearing me say things like that, I am more bored of it. I am really looking forward to a time when I don't say it's been a week or a month or a year of, you know, triggers or what have you. And honestly, I'm more and more I see that place on the horizon, because I have been hit hard, 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 hard over the month of October particularly. And while there have been some really low moments, they haven't lasted very long. And that's the story that I have to tell you today. So, I woke up tired and discouraged, and I had had a really difficult and somewhat unproductive week and weekend, because I had been significantly triggered by something that mirrored some of the more traumatic parts of my journey with complex PTSD due to childhood sexual abuse. If you're just tuning in to the first episode now, that's what I mostly talk about or have, and that does not mean that's what I will continue to talk about, but since that's been very pertinent to life right now, and it's a story that a lot of people can relate to, that's what I've been focusing the podcast on mostly. And so I had had a wonderful reprieve after a very rough month in October, where lots of things came to light, and I'll get to that. Where I went on this spectacular cruise with my husband, which was a gift in every sense of the word, and we were so grateful for it, because it was really just what we needed, and gracious people had allowed it to happen for us. Gracious beyond your wildest imaginings, really. And it had been perfect, and I felt a level and consistency of happiness that I have not felt for maybe ever, which gave me a lot of hope. And you know, I know you might say, well, you're on a cruise, and most people are happy the whole time they're on a cruise. But when you have PTSD, it doesn't really matter where you are, because if the triggers come, you're back to, we've talked about this, you're back to wherever you were when the bad things were happening. So you can be in paradise, literally, which the cruise was for me, and then not be able to enjoy it. And that's so sad. And so the fact that I was able to have so many consecutive days of pure joy and just release from those burdens and not feel triggered, and just be able to truly enjoy everything, felt like such a great gift, and I was really grateful for that. And I've really I really do recommend that you know, if you possibly can, reward yourself for the hard work you're doing. And not everybody gets to go on a cruise, and it was just a real, like I say, a gift and a coincidence that we were, and I'm so grateful for it. But you know, find ways to recognize yourself, even if it's a small thing, and to remind yourself you have done hard and good work and you deserve a break. And sometimes that just means not thinking about it or not doing the hard work, which doesn't mean like cancel your therapy, but leave the hard work in the therapist's office. You know, and just treat yourself in whatever way it is, and just recognize you are doing hard, good stuff. And when good things come to you, you deserve them. You deserve them. That I think is the hardest thing about this kind of PTSD, is that a lot of people feel very unworthy of happiness, and they are also suspicious of happiness when it happens, because they're not particularly familiar with it, or they tend to wait for the other shoe to drop all the time. That hypervigilance makes you inclined to think, oh, good things, what terrible thing is going to happen to compensate? Because often, if we were abused and stuff, that was inconsistent, or it would come out of the blue, or, you know, we were not raised in an environment where we could trust outcomes or know what was going to happen to us next. And so when good things happen, and you get sort of suspicious of them, or you won't allow yourself to enjoy them all the way, be cognizant that that's sort of part of the problem, that's part of the syndrome, and do a little bit of self-talk and remind yourself, I'm worthy of this, and this is a gift to me. Maybe to compensate for all the horror I've been through and for all the hard work I've done. So enjoy it. And then, you know, if you're not getting triggered and stuff, you really can enjoy it. So I was enjoying that tremendously. And then I came back to reality, and the timing of other revelations, just such that they are, just so happened that it was just, you know, as I came back to reality, some stuff just came to light. And the way I handled that affected some of my relationships, which are really precious to me, which made me feel isolated, which did trigger me tremendously, because it sort of mirrored the feelings that I'd had when I first talked about my abuse, and revealed my abuse to my mother, and she did not behave in any way appropriately, or properly supportively, or make it about me. It was more, she went into a defensive and protective mode, which is very common, for sufferers of sexual abuse to discover that if they do reveal it to a trusted adult, that adult cannot handle that truth, and they go defensive, for a variety of reasons. But that, is referred to in some circles as secondary abuse. And I know there's some confusion around the term secondary abuse, because it's used also to describe forms of PTSD that occur when people witness news coverage or whatever. But what I'm referring to is the abuse that happens when the abuse victim reveals their truth, and then they are undermined by people they trusted to believe them. And that's what I've discovered over the course of the last month. October was where I think most of my damage and most of the anguish of my life has occurred within. Abuse, of course, of a child, and of course sexual abuse, is particularly hard to overcome, particularly when it's your caregiver. In my case, the only father I ever knew was technically my stepfather, but had adopted me, and you know, in our religion, I'd been sealed to him. I knew no other dad. He fixed it so that I would know no other dad. There was sole custody. I never got to see nor even hear about, that topic was somewhat taboo in my house, my actual father. And so, he was the only dad I knew, and he had positioned himself to be this bastion of righteousness and goodness, and people all responded to him as though he was such. And so when he did this thing, it was very confusing and, of course, incredibly damaging. But more than that, and I would say that I've been actually quite resilient when it came to the sexual abuse. I have gone on to have a very healthy marriage and a very fulfilling, a sex life. And everything has actually been, I've been so fortunate in terms of recovering from things that can really, really damage a person in that way, from the actual abuse. So I have been, should I say, like I say, very resilient and also very fortunate in my response to the actual abuse. What was even worse, and look, I don't know, I can't separate every sort of, element. The sexual abuse and the psychological ramifications of that are vast and are very damaging into your adulthood in ways which do not have anything to do with your response to sex. So I'm not going to say, oh, well, everything was okay because of the sexual abuse. Of course not. And there's other ramifications that I have had to deal with, in my responses to just about everything. But what I really want to focus on and what I've been dealing with this month have been the devastating consequences of the secondary abuse. And I think so many people, and the more I've told the story of that, so many people have come out of the woodwork and said, this is what I'm facing. And they're around my age. They're women in their 30s and 40s who are like saying, yes, this is what I'm facing. And it's so devastating. And now that I know what's going on and what has been going on, they're starting to find themselves and separate themselves from the narrative that abusers and allies to the abusers will tell them. And that will actually shape your self-perception and self-worth as an adult just as much and just as badly as any kind of abuse that actively happens to you as a child. And it's so much more insidious, right? Because, even as a little kid, I knew that when I was being abused, it was bad. And I could separate that I wasn't bad, at least on a surface level. Lots of the insidious messages that came through that whole experience obviously did undermine me. But if anybody had asked me, I would have had the right answers. Did you deserve that? No. Is it because you're bad? No. Are you dirty because of it? No. I was pretty self-aware as a kid and as an adult that this was not my fault. Now, subconsciously, was I aware? Not as much, but I at least had the tools to recognize this was inappropriate. What he was doing to me was wrong, and he was sick. And while I had a lot of sympathy for him and a lot of protectiveness for him, I could tell that this was not what a dad should be doing to their child, and that it was not something I deserved, at least consciously. But then when you go ahead and you're at your most vulnerable and you share this information with somebody else and their response is not right and you don't have the backup or the knowledge or, other clear-headed people to tell you, wow, your mother's response there was thoroughly inappropriate. And what happened to you was very, very bad. And you are not this and this and that, which she has been telling me and groomed and prompted by him. And then the two of them kind of backing that narrative up by telling, siblings and family friends and everybody treating you that way and keeping you at sort of an arm's length and telling you in many subtle ways what a unstable person you are, or what an incredible witness you are. And maybe you did deserve it, or maybe you are exaggerating it, or maybe what happened to you isn't so bad, or maybe you're hearing straight out that you're a liar. I've heard that a lot of times from the horse's mouth himself. Even after he made full confessions, he would walk it back and then tell people that I was a liar, including my mother, and she would parrot that to my siblings. And so, these messages can come in a variety of ways, and they can just come from the way people deal with you, the way their voice changes, the way they look at you, the way any information you give them or any of their dealings with you that are totally unrelated. And then what's going to happen? What's going to happen? We all know. We respond, right? We respond, particularly when triggered. We kind of rise to whatever people are, or lower ourselves to whatever people expect of us. So if you tell the truth and then people say, well, I don't know what's wrong with you, you're crazy, that's not very bad, now shut up and get on with your life, everything's fine, then when those bad feelings rise within you and you don't know what's wrong with you and you wake up with a sick feeling because you've had dreams that you don't even remember about the abuse, and you wake up feeling sick and unmoored and depressed, you're going to tell yourself, shut up, get on with it. Why are you depressed? Look at you. You've got a nice husband. You've got a cute house. You've got wonderful children. Snap out of it, you stupid. There's nothing to see here, right? You're going to start, that will start to inform your self-worth. And the more you tell yourself this, and the more you push the truth of the horrors that happened to you down, down, down. And I got to the point where I was like, you don't need to tell anybody. You don't need therapy. My mother said, when I said, I need therapy, she said, Christy, you just like to talk about yourself. And I do, because look, I have a podcast. So she wasn't wrong there. So she took a grain of truth, and she used that. And yeah, I do like to talk about my experiences. I am an outspoken person. I am an expressive person, but I knew even at the age of a teenager that I needed therapy, and she knew I needed therapy. I was clearly a depressed individual at that time. Subconsciously, I think she also recognized that truths would surface that she did not want to deal with, and she did not want to have to cope with as a mom and as a wife. So these undermining messages I took and grasped. And if you have a particularly kind of charismatic abuser, or that the witness you tell is charismatic and strong-willed, you will believe, as I did. And people still to this day, this very morning, somebody said, but your mom is so nice. And I'm like, trust me. I know. She's great. She's very, very fun. And she's very warm. And she can be lovely. In fact, I wanted her to be my mom, even though she showed no signs of wanting to be a good mom to me, and pushed me away actively and ignored me and tried to get me to stop loving her for years, for most of my life. I kept trying, and up until maybe 3 weeks ago, to give this woman a second chance to say, Mom, please, I forgive you if you will cop to what you have done and get yourself free from this sick and malignant man. And let's see if you are actually complicit or if you're just brainwashed. I will give you another chance, as many chances. And then finally realized, no, this lady is not toxic, never has truly been interested in me. And often they're like a very kind of, they are very charismatic, they're very warm, they're very loving to other people, because they thrive in situations that they control and that they can see a positive outcome. So if people see them as wonderful, they will be wonderful. They will solve your problems. They will be very warm and loving. They will be their best selves with you. And in these low stakes situations, my mom shines. And so she has been a mother figure to countless people and has been very good at it and very successful, because those people, and she would say to my sister and I, who were both abused, and she knew on some level, she knew that we had been, and then she knew on every level at some point, she would say, you girls don't make me feel safe. I don't feel safe around you. You're always waiting to attack me. And I would say, we would say, what the hell are you talking about? We just want you to be our mom. We want you to be the same kind of good, loving mom as you are to all these people, and to our sister-in-laws, and to our brothers, actually. And she would say, yeah, but you don't make me feel safe. And we would say, well, we're not trying. We realized later we didn't make her feel safe because she knew the truth She knew the truth, and we reflected the truth. And so uncomplicated relationships, which nothing was required of her, where she had a clean slate to work with, she was super. And so this is what's really complicated, that sometimes you will tell somebody who has been good to you and is certainly good to other people, and they cannot deal with that truth. And then suddenly, for whatever reason, I've had friends like this who I tried to tell about this, and they were trusted friends, and they had their own defense mechanism. Either this was triggering their own stuff, that they were not ready to be a support, or, let's just leave it at that. It was triggering their own support, their own stuff, and they could not be what I needed them to be. And so then again, you go back into yourself going, well, I guess it's me, right? So the secondary abuse is when a victim of, and particularly happens to people who suffer from childhood sexual abuse, because when there's a physical abuse, you know, there's often a mark or something that we can point to, and a teacher will bring them forward and say, what happened to you? Where are all these marks? And I had that experience as a child, but I, you know, my marks were mostly hidden under my clothes. And I would lie about them. And so, you know, that wasn't my major scarring. But when you bring this up years later and you bring it up tentatively, or the confession is actually forced out of you before you're ready, people just notice you act funny, or somebody else around you acts funny, which was the case for me. And you're still really wanting to live in that place of denial, your initial confession is not very convincing. And then that sort of half-baked confession, why am I using the word confession? Telling of the truth, revelations, should I say, because you're not confessing to any sin. You did nothing wrong. So I hate that I use that expression, forgive me. But your revelations are not particularly compelling. And so your abuser will pounce on that, as mine did, and undermine everything, and that they will be very believable. So what happened to me in the last month, I've been working my way back. We've talked about the fact that I had this cruise that was a great reboot, and then this last week I had a really sort of undermining experience with my relationships, because people were unready to hear about further truths that were triggering me. And also, what also happened this week, I should probably clear up before I delve into the last month, was that my abuser saw fit to contact me and two other siblings who have levied accusations of abuse against him, and sent a scriptural verse to us, instructing us to not condemn him, in fact, to be grateful to him for, I'm laughing not because I think it's funny, I'm just in disbelief, I mean, at the audacity, to be grateful for the abuse, because at least it's shown us how not to be. So in some way, in his sick mind, I think he's trying to be terribly, terribly martyred and to say, look, you know, look at this gift I've given you. And I do recognize that I have failed, but now I see my failings, and be not thou as I have been. And I'm thinking, yeah, no, cool. No, I would never have been. I'm not a monster. I don't abuse my kids, and never would I. So thanks. I could have probably, certainly done without your abuse to get to the point that I am at now. So, but that happened, and that was ugly, and that was extraordinarily triggering. And so, this week ended with me going, lying in my bed, having nightmares, having such a visceral nightmare about this monster again next to my bed, ready to molest me, saying disgusting things to me. I saw his disgusting face up close and personal in a really real way that I'd been suppressing for lo these many years, and projecting my anger onto other people who deserved it less, maybe some of it, but far less than what he deserves it. And he finally unleashed this in me. And so this morning, when I woke up tired and feeling just so triggered and sad and tempted to just shut down my life and all the progress and all the things that I had hoped to achieve after I came back from this very healing cruise experience. I suddenly had the image, and I posted it on my social media, and maybe you saw it, or maybe you'll go back and see that, or watch the movie Wonder Woman if you haven't, or watch it again if you have, because you cannot watch that movie too many times if you're a survivor. And I pictured myself, not for the first time this weekend, but this morning I pictured myself as Diana. When she had finally, Ares had finally, it seemed, gotten the best of her in that final battle, and he had encased her around her heart and her throat, and her arms were pinned down. All her power seemed to be encapsulated in this metal encasing that he had confined her in. And all around her, war was waging, and the terror of it was raging around her, and she lay there just paralyzed and in agony. And she saw everything she had worked so hard to overcome falling, you know, about to be destroyed by Ares. And she saw the people, her allies, had run out of ammunition. And he was saying terrible things to her, undermining horrible things to her. And then she looked up and she saw her beloved. And she had grave misgivings about what he was going to do. She knew that he was going to sacrifice his life for the greater good. And she loved him, and she didn't want that to happen. And here she was paralyzed, and she thought, he's going to do this. I'm going to lose my beloved, and he's going to die in vain. And for a moment, it just looks like all is lost. And then the beloved does indeed, you can see his plane explodes. And he's done this for the love of his fellow man, to end the war, to destroy the terrible weapons of mass destruction. And she looks up at this and she finds the strength inside of herself that is born of great agony and sadness and despair. And it triggers this strength. And she says, no, no. And she rises in this great and beautiful explosion, gold, powerful explosion. And it comes from a place of pain and rage, but it also comes from a place of love. And PTSD feels to me, it keeps me flat on my back in my room. I shut down in a small, small ball, often fetal. And when I'm really triggered, I just go to sleep because I short circuit. And then I'm lost to the world. I'm not a mother. I'm not a friend. I'm not a voice for other people. I'm not a wife. I'm nothing. I'm in a dark, small space, and I'm encapsulated by the evil of this man and all of his minions who have kept me in this place. And over the weekend, I found myself saying, just like Diana, no, screaming back and using my pain and also my rage, but mostly my love, and picturing my children and saying, no, I will not let my children lose any more of me to this. And I know this sounds so dramatic, and it is, you guys. It is a fight for our lives. When we fight back against PTSD, it is a fight for our lives, and it is a fight for the lives of those people who love us. And so this weekend, when he slid into my inbox with this self-righteous, unrepentant bullshit, I decided, no. So I put his name on my Facebook page, which is very well read. I have a lot of reach, and I know that his friends read it. And I named him, and I said, this is what he's done to me this week. And it made me want to crawl up into my little ball, my dark hole of PTSD, and die. And I thought, I want to die. And several times over the week, I thought, If I'd had a quick way to end it, the instinct might have overtaken me, which is why guns are dangerous, because that instinct is strong, but it passes. But I thought of my children, and I thought of the courage that they've shown pushing through the sadness of watching their mom being paralyzed many, many times over. And still they rise, and still they go forward. And they are making a beautiful future. And it's tough. Tougher on some than others. But on all of them, at some point, it's going to be rough. And I thought, I will not make their life harder. I will not make my legacy this. And I will not make let this worm of a man define how I'm going to live the rest of my life. And if it takes doing what I've always been taught was distasteful and wrong, because in our family, secrecy and closing the ranks was beautiful and virtuous. And guess who taught us that? Somebody with something to hide. He loved secrets, and he loved privacy, and he loved, and it was very unseemly to speak out about experiences, or to even talk to your friends about what was going on, because he thrived in silence. So I went, and I did the most unseemly thing I thought I could. And you know what? People have been pushing back against me and my siblings all month for talking about what the abuse that we've suffered. And I'll get to that. And mostly family members, extended family members, who might have been taught in that same model. Who knows? Who've said, you know, think about the other people you're hurting when you tell your truth. The truth, folks, doesn't hurt people. It sets people free. The truth will always set people free. And it might inconvenience people, and it might make people very uncomfortable, but it will never do long-term harm the way secrets will. And your truth is yours to do with what you like and what will be most healing to you. You owe nobody your silence, and you don't owe anybody your public declaration either. But that's how I roll. I am a public person, and I feel a call to be a voice for other people. And I use my pain as publicly and as vocally as possible, because I am healed by finding out that other people have been healed and empowered by it. And that's not everybody's journey, and I'm not saying that everybody has to do that. But if you do, do not hesitate. If you feel, wouldn't it be nice to name that person and shame that person and bring their evil doing to light and put it out there so that people can be protected from them and can know who they are? Or I can get a tribe behind me, because maybe the person you chose to tell was like my mother and was not the right person to tell. It was like a friend who was not ready because it triggered their crap. You will find a tribe. You will find a lot of voices who will empower you, as I did. And some of those voices I don't even know. In fact, more people I don't know have been incredibly supportive and empowering and comforting to me than people I do know, particularly people I knew in my childhood. A lot of them have stayed silent out of shock or not wanting to rock the boat or God only knows what. It's a huge disappointment to me, but I have cut them out because that's toxic. If you do not have people who support you actively and completely, you don't need to keep them in your life. You don't need to have loyalty towards these people, because they will continue to validate the toxic narratives that have been told by your abusers and by people who back them up, that your story is not that bad. They will undermine your responses to it, and they will keep you from seeking the healing help that you need. And most of the work my therapist has done with me, and then later on with my brother who came to visit, is to just say, you have experienced something really terrible, and what he did was very bad. And you, ultimately, the end goal, yes, your end game will be healing and forgiveness. That is where you will find ultimately peace. And I visit that place all the time, by the way. I visit a place where I'm at peace with my abuser, and I am indifferent to what happens. I don't wish him any harm. In fact, sometimes I hope that he can heal. And I mostly feel very, very bad for him. But there are times where I feel an excess anger. and that is just as healthy. It's not the end game, and it's not where you need to live ultimately. Ultimately, you need to come to a place of peace and love and acceptance and release. But you do need to visit anger and acknowledgement of what has happened to you. And that is what my therapist has been working on, because my mother undermined that natural reaction. And so did the abuser, my father himself, my stepfather, undermined those natural reactions for so, so long and made it about me being this and that and all sorts of other things. And I had, you know, their posse back up that narrative until I swallowed it whole and was filled with self-loathing and thought of myself as pathetic and unreliable, and I couldn't rely on my own self, right? So I didn't do any of the things that I was capable of doing or have the potential to do, because every time I got anywhere in my life, I thought, you know what? You don't deserve this. You're all the things your mom has quietly told you are. And she might have said, she said plenty of encouraging words to me over time, but more than not, she said undermining things in terms of not allowing me to heal, not seeking healing on my behalf, not acknowledging her part in my pain, undermining, gaslighting. Gaslighting is probably the most damaging thing people can do to you. And you need to become a real, real expert on that, because you will attract people into your life who, as soon as you know you're damaged, for one thing, other than your abuser themselves, if you reveal that you've been damaged, there will be people who are actively attracted to that damage and feel like they can take advantage of you. So you really do need to become an expert on what gaslighting looks like and what that feels like and how to shut it down. And that's been an ongoing challenge for me too, which has really needed some deprogramming from therapy. So being able to just come out and say and do this, what would be considered in my family and to whom, great swaths of people who I honestly don't care about because they don't care about my healing, as very unseemly and unclassy and all the things, but was necessary for my healing, is to name the person and to say, guess what he did? Guess what highly inappropriate and unrepentant thing he did this morning? And those people helped me get out of bed, but mostly it was love. So in the midst of your pain, contact in your mind and in your heart what you love and what is worth living for. And put that together with your anger and your righteous indignation and anything else you need to just keep going. That's how I got out of bed this Monday morning after this grueling week and this painful weekend. Next up, let's talk about what I've discovered over the course of the last month a little more. I have touched on that, but let's talk about that a little more. Okay, so my brother, Seth, who I was extremely close to growing up, has recently moved to Arizona. And the backstory was that over time, Seth and I had been somewhat estranged, as I had been toward most of my siblings, because I could no longer deal with the lack of boundaries that I saw in my in the wake of my telling my siblings what had been done to me. They were extremely outraged, very supportive, my brother Luke. He is excluded from any kind of support. He's in my parents' camp, and that should be well understood. The rest of my siblings were all horrified by what had happened to me, and they were determined to bring a full confession out of him. For me to get the help that I needed and all that kind of thing. So that was great initially. That happened about 3-4 years ago. And my brother Seth really waged a very, very powerful stand against my stepfather and extracted a full confession, which cost me a lot in terms of my PTSD. Was extremely horribly triggered by having to tell Seth exactly what had happened to me, because when I told my mother, things were really watered down, and then, you know, I didn't tell her specifically what happened to me. I assumed that when she confronted him, he would tell her. I don't know what made me think that. I was also still in so much denial, and she never bothered to get any kind of therapist involved in the process, or, you know, bring us all together to tell the story in any way. So of course the lies thrived, and he whitewashed the whole thing. So then at a later date, and she also encouraged me never, never, never to tell my siblings or anybody else about this, which I duly did. But then relationships with my siblings were becoming so strained, because I saw what this man was, and they didn't know what he had done to me. And they were really unhappy with the change in my attitude. Towards the end of the time, I had gone back to South Africa, believing that my father had gone through an entire repentance process. I was still believed that that could happen, and that he had worked through, with the help of therapists, everything. And I, being a naturally really forgiving person, was totally down with that. And I also sort of bought into the whole religious narrative that once, you know, your sins have been cleansed by God, then they exist no more, and I was good to go. And so when I went back to South Africa under this pretense, and then I discovered who he really was, that he was not repentant, that he had not changed, of course I was horrified and beat it out of there as soon as possible to live far away from him and take my kids far away. And I know it sounds insane that I had brought them there, but I had been under the illusion, I'd been told that everything was dealt with and that he was a new man. And so as soon as I discovered that he wasn't, or just even signs in terms of his demeanor and his lack of ability to take responsibility for what he had done, or even tried to pretend he hadn't done anything to me, I was aghast, and I cut ties with him immediately. And of course my siblings were just getting the narrative from him and my mom that I'd had some kind of tantrum and flounced out of there, and they saw me as very unreasonable and ungrateful and hurtful towards the parents they loved, which was understandable. So at that point, when I had nothing left to lose with my siblings and I could see my relationships with them was in pure peril, I and also they were starting to have kids. They had a couple of them had young daughters, and seeing what I saw and seeing that he was unrepentant, I thought the time has come. And unfortunately, I told them after having sort of had a really triggered experience with them, and often that will motivate truth when you're just so angry and you're so triggered that you don't see any other way. And so that is what Luke bases his skepticism on. He validates his skepticism using that experience. His skepticism is based on the fact that he prefers, as far as the rest of us can see, he prefers comfort to truth. It rocks his boat and his world view far too much to accept what his father actually is, because that's very painful. So it's easier to just take a sister who he believes behaved badly and accept my parents' spit on that. And so that's the direction he's gone on that. So that should be, you know, a lot of people keep coming to me and asking me what's going, you know, and how about Luke? And that's where Luke stands. Luke has betrayed the truth for his own comfort, and he uses the fact that I told the truth in a triggered state to justify that. And I'm telling you, I'm putting that out there as factually and without malice as I can. If Luke ever were to actually come to me and say, I'm so sorry for what has happened to you, and I would like a chance to work with you and to be your brother, and I denounce these people, I would be open to that, but that's not how Luke is rolling. So since all the other family secrets are out, that's where Luke stands, and that's where I stand with Luke. But Seth had come to the States and had been away from my parents long enough and was revisiting what he had done initially and what he had seen from my dad when he forced my dad, that full confession out of my dad. And when I say my dad, I'm regarding, this is my stepfather, my abuser. So Seth had really gone to battle with him. There was no love lost between him and Seth, but Seth is a really good person who, because of his own issues, was very invested in maybe helping my, seeing, you know, if he could heal, seeing if he, there was any part of him that could be redeemed, and was taken for a long time by this man's evil ways, his narcissism, his spinning of the story. And I, from my distance, observed that my siblings' boundaries, everyone other than my oldest sister, who had seen my father for what he was long before the rest of us, and had been ostracized by the family at large, including myself from time to time, because she would not tolerate him. She saw the truth, and she would not tolerate him. And, you know, she got the brunt of sort of being ousted by the family because of the subtle things he would say, shown as, you know, crazy, or shown as mean, or shown as this and that, and, you know, just subtly, and he would be a martyr to that, and very, very clever about it. He would never outwardly say, oh, you should reject Shona, ever, because he was far too smart for that. Because, you know, any sibling would say, well, we're not going to do that to our sister, but, you know, spin the tail, or just smile sadly when she acted out towards him. So he was a martyr in order to arouse our sympathies towards him. And that's how he worked. So anyway, to come circle back, I had decided that for the sake of my own healing, I could not roll with my siblings, even though I knew that they didn't, you know, they were not, they did not for in any way excuse what he had done. They believed me. They were still hanging out with him, and their lives seemed, from where I was sitting, I was the only one suffering. I was the only one cut off from the family. I was the only one experiencing the true reality of what had happened to me. And everybody else was kind of in this weird state of no man's land. And the boundaries were confusing to me and were really hindering my ability. And what my therapist was trying to do was to say, what happened to you was bad. You're not bad. What happened to you was bad. Isolate what has happened to you. Isolate that a very inappropriate response to what happened to you has been what you've been working with as an adult all this time, and damaging yourself with these perceptions of yourself for all this time. So eventually it got to the point that it was just not tenable for me to have a relationship with them anymore, to see them hanging out with him. And I did not know, you know, from where I was standing, I couldn't see how they acted towards him, but I just felt like any contact with this man, who was a pedophile, was not okay. Or with my mother, frankly, who was enabling a pedophile, was not okay. So our relationship had become extraordinarily strained, and we were not talking. And he came to the States and had moved, and so we were having very kind of brief email updates on his progress. And then one day he told me, you know, he really needed to be with family, and my sort of nurturing side, my loving side as his sister, took over, and I invited him to come and stay with me for a while. And that led to some conversations prior to the time that he even came, where he started to tell me that he was starting to see more and more who I really was, and how that did not match up with what my parents had been telling him for the last 20 years. Now, this was painful to me, because maybe in my heart I knew that they were undermining me, but I always hoped and sort of hoped, or some part of me, the little girl part of me, believed that they actually loved me and wanted the best for me. But it turned out they didn't. They wanted the best for themselves, and I was in the way of that. So the narrative had to be that I was not somebody who could be trusted or believed, or and that essentially I was the bad one in some sort of warped way. And Seth knew that, you know, on a conscious level, that I wasn't the bad one, that I'd been abused, but he thought that I was so damaged that, you know, no relationship really could be had with me. And that's how they wanted it, because so long as I wasn't talking to him, then their narrative could continue to be the strongest thing in everybody's ears. And that narrative started when we were little. When my stepfather was grooming me to be his victim from the earliest of ages, he was also grooming everybody else in my family not to believe me, right? And to make me incredible, so that if I ever spoke up, it was like, we know Kirsty, so over the top. You know, so all the qualities that do define me, I am a vocal person, and I am an excitable person, and I am a person who tells good stories and is prone to hyperbole in telling those stories. But I'm not prone to hyperbole when it comes to reporting crimes and abuse. In fact, the total opposite. I downplayed that or hid it entirely for almost all of my life. So, but he really played up that. And then, you know, did she really? What, in the end, you know, people were left confused as to whether I was abused at all. And so the distance from both my mother and my father allowed Seth to see clearer than I could even see the damage that had been done to me and the messages that had been done to me, because he started to tell the messages that he had received. And then I recognized them as the same messages I had received. And this was incredibly validating. So one day, in the midst of the Kavanaugh brouhaha that was happening in the country, and many, many sexual abuse victims were highly triggered, including myself during that time, Seth told me some things that made me particularly hurt and angry as to how my parents had been sort of grooming my siblings and anybody else who knew me or might be sympathetic toward me, to treat me and to take any information that I might disclose, and, you know, not see it at face value. And so Seth told me that, and at the time I became very angry. But something helped me to learn from my mistakes, and I thought, I'm not going to react in any way while I'm angry. And so I waited a full 24 hours after that information. And at the same time, something else that happened was that I received a message from a childhood friend who said so innocently and so sweetly, I saw your mom on a plane and she's so lovely. And that is the narrative from pretty much everybody who knows my mom. To know her is to love her. And I think I wrote a poem, which has since been burned into the range above her stove, which I hope that she will remove, because none of those sentiments hold true anymore. But, you know, she is an incredibly lovable, charismatic person. And she said, your mother is just so lovely. And I was so triggered by that. And I lost a full weekend because of the combination of information. You know, I was just like, I have to constantly be out of the blue triggered by hearing about my mom when my life is going just fine. And after I'd lost that weekend, I sort of sat quietly with myself and felt no anger and nothing. And I decided to write my own hashtag why I didn't report. But I wrote it about the mothers. And I said, what about the mothers? I am reading all about all these women who disclosed just a little bit about their rape. They told their mothers, and their mothers told them not to go to the police, or their mothers didn't believe them, or their mothers were so hurt, or they were terrified of how their mothers would react, you know, because their mothers had told them, if you ever come home, rape, don't come home to me, or just terrible, terrible things. And I could see, because of course I was tuned into that betrayal from my own mother, I could see that this was not an unusual pattern. And indeed, over the last weekend, I've heard from so many women who have said the same thing. You know, my mother, I told my mother and she downplayed it because she felt guilty or she was somehow complicit or what have you. So these mothers often play a role. And as women or as mothers ourselves, this is particularly repugnant to us because we know that this is our primal job, right? We are required to protect our children above all. And then when our mothers have failed us in this way, we just can't wrap our minds around it. So I just spoke to, you know, how my mother is very charismatic, how she did lots of good things in mothering me, but how she ultimately failed me. In both in allowing the abuse to happen because her boundaries in our home were very poor, and she, you know, she may say that she did not know the sexual abuse was going on, but she certainly was aware of the physical abuse. And sometimes she would, often she would call upon our father to avenge her with the physical abuse, which was ridiculous because we were very well-behaved kids and, you know, she was very fragile egoed. So I think that's kind of how she got his attention, or she got his, she felt loved by him, was when he would basically beat us in response to things that she felt we had done to undermine her. So it was a very, very sick dynamic in a home. But I spoke to that. I spoke to what about the mothers? And years ago, I wrote an article about, you know, these female lionesses who would watch as the new, if you know, if the lion of the pride somehow was killed off by a younger, more virile lion, or he died in some other way, and the younger lion came in to, you know, take his spot, he would often kill the existing cubs of the previous lion. And I was fixated by this when I saw it on the net, on the Nature Channel. I was fixated, and at first I felt so sorry for the mothers. Like, wow, you know, these mothers will just, you know, the things they must endure to have this lion come in and kill their cubs in front of them. And then later on in life, I thought, I've reflected back on this, and I thought, why the hell didn't the lionesses fight back? They're the ones who go and get the food. They could have protected their cubs any day. They could have banded together as women and taken on these guys. And I guess that was my subconscious becoming more healthy and going, no, 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 mom, no. What you did was bad. But anyway, so all that to say, I sort of came from the angle of the mothers. Why do the mothers keep failing us in this way? What the hell, mothers? You need to step up, you know? Step up and tell your children ahead of time that you will protect them under all circumstances. You will believe that anybody harmed them, even if it's your own spouse, even if it's a sibling. They must know that they will be believed and protected. And so that was my mission. And there was no vengeance in my mission. I truly felt that my words would be lost. I was not trying to be sensationalistic. It was part of a huge campaign that was going on. I was one of hundreds of thousands in that hashtag of why I didn't report. It was a movement which I added my voice to. But what happened was is that that kind of took traction because my brother accidentally, who was very much on my side at that point, accidentally shared that. He didn't mean to, but he shared it to his page. And then when he saw it there, he felt, no, this is right. And not only did he do that, he also overcame the family narrative of we keep things silent and we keep things under wraps. And his own lack of, he really doesn't like social media and he doesn't like public scrutiny. He added to it a very compelling kind of character witness for me and talked about how the secondary abuse, what I dealt with, in terms of being undermined after I did tell my truth for 20 years, the damage that it had done to me and the damage that it had done to our relationships as siblings. And he spoke very, very powerfully to that, for which I'd always be very grateful. Everybody needs somebody like that in their life. And everybody needs to understand secondary abuse because it keeps so many of us down and so many of us in suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, not getting the help we need, not receiving that validation and not receiving the freedom to say what happened to me was incredibly wrong and incredibly damaging, and it is not who I am. And so having that really kind of emboldened and empowered me, and it really did open the floodgates of support, because that's when people started to sit up and take note. And people in, you know, my parents' community started to take note and decry it. Not enough of them. Many of them still sit in silence, which is thoroughly disappointing and abhorrent as far as I'm concerned. If you ally with, once, you know, witnesses have come out against, and I think we should always believe survivors as our default mode, I really do, because the statistics of people coming out and saying that they have been abused and that being false are so infinitesimal compared to the statistics of how many people live in this unimaginable and destructive pain and sometimes kill themselves or become addicted to all sorts of terrible things to soothe that awful pain inside of them that tells them that they're worthless, and that PTSD, those lies that will tell you that the only way out is to die. The statistics of that are so much higher than people who false report. So believe survivors as your default. Truly, do it. You will save lives. And I think ultimately we will also see lower incidence of abuse. The less we are shielding people in this shroud of secrecy and silence, you know, this is how abusers, they count on the fact that people won't speak out. Or if they do, nobody will believe them. And they tell people that. They tell their victims that. Nobody will believe you. And they often pose as the best of the best of the best. They're often the bastions of society. They're often the best guy at church, you know. I mean, I thought, even when he was doing this to me, I still thought my dad was the most holy person because he never swore. And he always kept a very gentle voice. And he did a lot of good that other people could see. This is how narcissists do. They act very, very good in the public eye. They're very, very clever about what they do. So, you know, this was a very, very healing experience when my brother backed me up, and then later on my sister backed me up publicly. And when you have the support of others, when more voices add and witnesses add and people say, I have got you and that person was wrong, the proper healing can begin. And so that secondary abuse, I have recognized more and more and more
as being the real thing that I am combating now, that I'm fighting against right now, to fight against those messages that I've been receiving, you know, about myself. Because like I said, when the abuse itself, you can separate in your mind from you, you can separate that from your identity and who you are. But the secondary abuse is far more insidious, far harder to unwind from who you are. And we as a society can do so much to help people to overcome that. When we position ourselves publicly as allies, when we do believe survivors and we are vocal about that. During the Kavanaugh, that weekend of the Kavanaugh thing, I felt very, very moved upon to be as vocal as possible in every possible way, to be a voice of support for survivors, because I was aware, just from my own experience, that many people were quietly suffering and dying inside that weekend. That young girls were hearing conversations between their parents, maybe their mothers, saying, this is ridiculous, Me Too has gone too far, I wouldn't believe her either. And wondering how they would ever be able to get help for the abuse that they had experienced as a young child, or maybe as that they had recently experienced, or a date rape that they had experienced. And perhaps they just internalize this for the future. And when something like that does happen to them, they think many, many times over, or just out of hand reject the idea of coming forward. And so that weekend, I felt so moved that I wanted to be as vocal as possible in my support. And it so happened that it was our daughter's homecoming weekend, and she was on the homecoming court. And I hastily asked somebody to make me a t-shirt that said, "I believe survivors," in as sparkly letters as I could, because I was going to walk her across the football field, you know, escort her as part of the homecoming court. And I was aware that my target audience were all sitting there, that all those high school girls were sitting there, and their football fan dads who may stand one side or the other on the issue, but through social media were giving me the impression there was a marked lack of support from your average Joe male in the thing. And suddenly there was a whole movement with hashtag what about him or him too, or some craziness about how we're so worried about our sons and other men who might be falsely accused. And it was just derailing this narrative of support for actual victims. And like I said, the odds of your son being sexually assaulted himself are far greater than your son being falsely accused of sexual assault. So sit with that, you know, if you have concerns. And let's place them in the right spot. And you know, it was a small little token thing, but I felt so helpless at that time and so enraged by what was going on. And I wore that t-shirt, and my daughter was so cool about it, because when your teenage daughter, and this wasn't supposed to be about me, remember, this is her moment to shine. And I said, you know, I'll wear a jacket, you know, if anybody happens to see me, but I just need girls out there to know that there is a friendly voice. One way or the other, I just feel like. And she said, "No, that's cool, do it." And you know, and then I posted that t-shirt on social media. But local girls contacted me that very same day. Local girls, you know, inboxed me, and they literally said, "You're the only person I feel like who will understand this." And I was so aghast, because we live in a college town which has plenty of support and plenty of educated people in the fields of psychology. And, you know, we talk a good game about, you know, supporting each other in this town. And there are tons of people who would support them. But the fact remained that some of these girls literally felt like I was the only person. And I was really concerned by that. I was really concerned by that, because people are out there, but we need to talk about it more. We need to be very much out there, and know, and we need to let survivors know that they will be believed, and we will have their back, and that truth and goodness and light will overcome evil, and it will not stand up to the scrutiny of goodness and light. And there are lots of people there. Even if your family betrays you, even if the friends you have now don't believe you, there are countless, countless people out there who have your back, just like who have had my back this weekend. I mean, the outrage of hundreds of strangers and people willing to film my father with unsolicited mail in his mailbox, telling them exactly what they think. That was just a really touching gesture to me. And you know what? He most probably won't read it, and he most probably will block his email account or do whatever he does in order not to face up to what he's done, because that's how he does. But that gesture means a lot to me as a survivor. And what's even more important is that it means a lot to all the quiet observers, and at least at least a handful of other people the same weekend have come out and said, "I'm feeling braver about naming my abuser. I'm going to do that." I know that there was a time when I felt too horrified by the truth to even acknowledge it to myself. I practiced so many avoidant behaviors. I remember seeing, as a young woman, around 20 years old, seeing on a hotel room Spanish for "please don't disturb," and it had the word "molest," and I was so like triggered by that, I avoided walking past any door that had that sign on for the rest of the trip. That's how avoidant my behavior was, to avoid. And you know, the journey that I've taken has been a very, very long and painful one, to where I am not afraid to speak out on any form of social media, to speak out in front of anybody from the tallest tower, and to say exactly what this man has done to me, because it is not me, it is him. and it has nothing to do with me, and me speaking out has also nothing bad to say about me. And that I believe deep in my heart for a long time, because a lot of people are very uncomfortable with emotional displays or displays of truth in general. And that is what keeps darkness powerful. And we need to become a lot more comfortable with uncomfortable topics and exposing them to the light so that they can be healed. And so that's my message, truly, as the takeaway today. If you have been a victim of any kind of abuse, get help. You deserve it. Secondly, if you haven't, position yourself loudly and proudly as an ally, because people need to know you're out there. I had the security of a very supportive husband, and then, you know, these family members who are newly behind me, and some other really good friends, when I sort of reached my tipping point and named his name on social media. And I am 42, and I am naturally fairly bold and outspoken, and don't particularly need to be liked. But that is not true for most people. Most people have one, at least one of those components missing. And we need to let them know that if your tribe now doesn't have your back, you can find a whole new tribe who will. And that is the only way to heal, is to find that tribe who will tell you the truth about the situation and point you in the right direction and let you extricate from the toxicity and the lies and the filth that have bound you up. So if you need that picture of Diana just rising from that impossibly binding, awful scenario that she appeared to be in that looked like all was lost, remember that even if you don't have love in your heart for something, there is so much love outside of you that is so ready to break those chains for you and to work with you. There's so much love surrounding you. The world is not the dark, toxic, disbelieving place that we sometimes start to believe it is when we look at the media and when we surround ourselves with all these sad stories. There are a lot of good, beautiful people who are strong and love truth and love you. And so please take that with you and hang on. Even if you can't rise up like Diana today, just hold on, because it's in you and there are a lot of other people there ready to hold your hands and pull you up. And I am one of them. Thank you so much for listening today. Thank you so much if you've been part of my tribe, who have had my back, who have supported me, who have shared my story, who have given me any kind of support and encouragement at any stage of my journey. You are in my heart. You're forever held in my esteem, and I have so much gratitude for you, because we all have a part to play in this world that nobody else can really play, and every single kind word has been stored away as an inoculation against filth and lies and, you know, lack of trust and all those things, and they count. All this goodness truly does count. So keep being the good, wonderful people you are. And thank you so much. Please share this podcast. I do think that it's a very relevant topic. And I do think that it's important that as many people, both as survivors and allies, hear it. And if you are an abuser, you better stop, because we are going to find you. The world is no longer a safe place for you. All right. With that, much love to all, and I will talk to you soon. Bye.